he will not agree to work or stand a guard. There was more. If miffed with any man, he wishes to return when he pleases, also have the disposal of as much provisions as he chooses to carry. Inadmissible, Clark and Lewis flatly declared. They told Charbonneau to move out of the fort, taking his family with him, and they hired Mr. Gravelines as interpreter. After 4 days of living in the Mandan village, Charbonneau sent a message to the captains via one of the Frenchmen to excuse his simplicity and take him into the service. Did he come to his senses on his own, or did the Frenchman tell him what a fool he was, what a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity he was passing up? Or was it Sacagawea who said she absolutely had to go see her people and participate in this great adventure? However it happened, Charbonneau was ready to crawl. The captain sent word for him to come to the fort for a discussion. He showed up on March 17th. "We called him in," Clark reported. "He agreed to our terms, and we agreed that he might go on with us, etc., etc." The roster for the expedition was complete. The permanent party that was getting ready to head west consisted of the 3 squads of enlisted men, each with its sergeant, plus the 2 captains, and 5 persons from outside the military establishment, namely Driard, York, Charbonneau, Sacagawea, and Jean-Baptiste, nicknamed Pomp or Pompey by Clark. By February 4th, Lewis noted in his journal, the expedition had run out of meat. That morning, Clark set out on his hunting expedition. The next day, Lewis reported that the immediate problem of scanty provisions had been overcome, although not with meat but with corn, and thanks to a bellows rather than a rifle. Private John Shields was a skilled blacksmith. He had set up for business at the expedition's forge and bellows inside the fort. There he mended iron hoes, sharpened axes, and repaired firearms for the Indians in exchange for corn. But by the end of January, business was turning sour. The market for mending hoes had been satisfied. Shields needed some new product to attract business. The arms trade was the obvious answer. Not in firearms, the captains turned away all requests for rifles or pistols, but in battle axes. There was a particular form of battle axe highly prized by the Indians and easily made by Shields. Lewis disapproved of the design, writing that it was formed in a very inconvenient manner, in my opinion. The blade was too thin and too long, the handle too short, the overall weight too little, all of which combined to make a weapon that made an uncertain and easily avoided stroke. But arms merchants give the customer what he wants. Shields went to work, getting his sheet iron from an all but burned out stove. Some of the men were detailed to cutting timber to provide wood to make a charcoal kiln to expand production capacity. Still, the Americans couldn't turn out battle axes fast enough. The Indians were skilled traders who drove hard bargains. On February 6th, Lewis had Shields cut up what was left of the stove into pieces of 4 inches square, which could then be worked into arrow points or buffalo hide scrapers. After some haggling, a price was set, 7 to 8 gallons of corn for each piece of metal. Each side thought it had made a great bargain. In his February 6th journal entry, Lewis paid tribute to Shields and his helpers. "The blacksmiths take a considerable quantity of corn today in payment for their labor. The blacksmiths have proved a happy resource to us in our present situation, as I believe it would have been difficult to have devised any other method to have procured corn from the natives." Lewis gave the full credit to Shields when he might well have split it, giving at least some to the Indians for having the corn available in the first place. Working as hard as they did in such extreme cold weather, the men ate prodigiously, 6,000 calories or even more per day. A modern athlete seldom consumes more than 5,000, but the calories the men were getting in 1805 contained very little, if any, fat. Consequently, no matter how much they ate, the men were always hungry. It was Mandan corn that got the expedition through the winter. Had the Mandans not been there, or had they had no corn to spare, or had they been hostile, the Lewis and Clark expedition might not have survived its first winter. Lewis never put it that way, and in fact probably never thought of it that way. 2 days after writing the passage praising Shields for procuring corn, Lewis had a visit from the chief of the Upper Mandan village, Black Cat. Lewis had been with him in Black Cat's village on January 2nd and other occasions. This was Black Cat's 17th visit to Fort Mandan. He brought presents, including a fine bow. Lewis gave him some fishing hooks and some ribbon. Black Cat's squaw gave Lewis 2 pairs of handsome moccasins. He gave her a mirror and a couple of needles. Black Cat stayed to dine at the captain's quarters. That evening, Lewis wrote in his journal, "This man possesses more integrity, firmness, intelligence, and perspicuity of mind than any Indian I have met within this quarter, and I think with a little management he may be made a useful agent in furthering the views of our government." A remarkable sentence. In the first half, Lewis obviously was speaking from the heart. Clearly, he enjoyed being with and greatly respected Black Cat. Yet in the second half of the sentence, he blandly discusses his plans to manage and manipulate his friend for the benefit of the United States. A further problem is this. What were the views of the Americans? On the one hand, peace. Lewis and Clark always preached peace to the Indians, giving them what the Americans thought of as overwhelmingly powerful reasons to avoid war. On the other hand, the Americans were arms merchants. As James Rhonda puts it, "Typical of this dilemma was the request from a war chief who came to purchase an axe and obtain permission to attack Sioux and Arikara warriors. For the proper price in corn, the axe was handed over, but the request to use it was denied." The Hidatsa chief must have wondered what sort of man would sell arms to a warrior and then tell him not to engage the enemy. The winter at Fort Mandan involved hunting, trading, keeping fit, dealing with the cold, doing extensive repairs to old equipment and building new canoes, visiting the Indians, and much more. But for Meriwether Lewis, it was primarily a winter of scholarship, of research and writing. For most of the day, most days, he was involved in gathering information or writing down what he had learned. He had endless discussions with the Indians about what lay out west, or what this or that faraway tribe was like. Or he bent over his writing desk in his smoky room, with a candle for illumination, dipped his quill into the inkstand, and wrote for hours on end. His subject was America west of the Mississippi River. He wrote about what he had seen and learned, and what he had heard. He tried to think like Jefferson, to anticipate what the president would want to know, or to guess how the president would present this or that subject. And what of Jefferson, meanwhile? What did he know about where the expedition was and how it was doing? Precious little. He had no direct word from Lewis after the expedition left St. Charles. The Osage chiefs whose visit Lewis had arranged arrived in Washington in July 1804. In greeting them, Jefferson spoke of his beloved man, Captain Lewis. On January 4, 1805, Jefferson wrote Lewis's brother, Reuben, to report that he had just learned, apparently by word of mouth, via a trapper who had returned to St. Louis that fall, that on August 19th the expedition was near the mouth of the Platte. According to the report, no accident had happened, and he, Lewis, had been well received by all the Indians on his way. It was expected that he would winter with the Mandans, 1,300 miles up the river. Jefferson predicted that the expedition would reach the Pacific during the coming summer, then return to the Mandan villages for the winter of 1805-6. If so, the president cheerfully concluded, we may expect to see him in the fall of 1806. Chapter 17. Report from Fort Mandan, March 22nd to April 6th, 1805. New life was stirring. On the first day of spring, it rained, the first rain since fall. The river ice began to break up. Ducks, swans, and geese sometimes seemed to fill the sky. The Indians set fire to the dry grass to encourage new grass to come up, for the benefit of their horses and to attract the buffalo. By the end of March, the ice was coming down in great chunks, along with drowned buffalo who had been on the ice when it gave way. I observed extraordinary dexterity of the Indians in jumping from one cake of ice to another, Clark wrote on the 30th, for the purpose of catching the buffalo as they float down. The joy of spring was everywhere, and doubly welcome by the men of the expedition, who had just survived the coldest winter any of them had ever known. They worked with enthusiasm, eager to get going again. Teams of men were repairing the boat, while others were building canoes, packing, making moccasins, making jerky, pumping the bellows. They sang as they worked. In the 5 months between May and October 1804, the captains and their men had traveled more miles than many of their contemporaries would do in a lifetime. In the 5 months between November 1804 and April 1805, they had stayed in one place. The anticipation of getting going on the river again was so keen it was almost unbearable. On the last day of March, Clark wrote, "All the party in high spirits, but few nights pass without a dance. Possessing perfect harmony and good understanding towards each other. Generally healthy, except venereals complaints, which is very common." On April 5th, the keelboat and the two pirogues that had come down the Ohio and then up the Mississippi and Missouri to Fort Mandan, along with 6 new canoes, were put into the water. They would be packed the next day, then set off on April 7th. The keelboat headed downstream for St. Louis, while the two pirogues and the lighter and more maneuverable canoes headed upstream, where the river would gradually become shallower and swifter. As the men went about their work, the captains wrote. So much writing did they do that Clark complained he had no time to write his family. Lewis managed to work in a letter to his mother, but most of it was unoriginal. He just copied passages from his report to Jefferson. The captains worked with passion and dedication. For several weeks, Lewis did nothing but write, eat, and sleep. There was so much to say. He felt he needed to justify the expedition. He wanted to please Jefferson, to be able to report that they had discovered what he had hoped they would, to answer his questions, to promote his program for the development of Louisiana. Even more, the captains wanted to be accurate in all their observations. They were men of the Enlightenment, dedicated to collecting facts and then putting the new knowledge to work for the good of mankind. So, in addition to describing the geography, the soils, the minerals, the climate, they had the responsibility of describing the tribes and of making recommendations on the economic future of Louisiana. They needed to make available in permanent form as much as they could of what they had learned. Lewis was determined to get these jobs done and done right. In his mind, everything that had happened since Jefferson put him in command was preliminary to the expedition, which was only now about to begin. On April 7th, the Corps of Discovery would set out into territory no white man had entered. Thus far, as Gary Moulton writes, all the men's efforts had been directed to reaching a point where other whites had ventured before them on a route already mapped. But although the expedition had yet to do any exploring, the captains had managed to pick up a tremendous amount of new information on Upper Louisiana, its flora and fauna, its climate and fertility, its peoples and their wars and their economies. Put together correctly and properly organized and labeled, all this information would constitute the first systematic survey of the Trans-Mississippi West and would thus provide an invaluable contribution to the world's knowledge, and equally invaluable to the United States government and American businessmen, frontier farmers, fur traders, and adventurers. The captains collected information in 2 basic ways. First and foremost, from their own observations. Second, by making local inquiry. They asked questions about the surrounding country of every Indian and white trader they met. These information gathering sessions sometimes lasted a full day, occasionally even longer. Jefferson had a passion for Indian language, believing he would be able to trace the Indians' origins by discovering the basis of their language. So the gathering of vocabularies was an important charge on the captains. They put a major effort into attempting to render words from various Indian languages into an English spelling. Mackenzie was present once to see the captains at work on their vocabularies. The language being recorded was Hidatsa. A native speaker would say a word to Sacagawea, who would pass it on in Hidatsa to Charbonneau, who would pass it on in French to Gisomme, who would translate it into English for the captains. Mackenzie thought Gisomme's English ranged somewhere between inadequate and non-existent, magnifying the chances for error. On another occasion, Mackenzie wrote, "I was present when vocabularies were being made of the Mandans. The two Frenchmen, Charbonneau and Gisomme, had warm disputes upon the meaning of every word that was taken down by the captains. As the Indians could not well comprehend the intention of recording their words, they concluded that the Americans had a wicked design upon their country. Despite the difficulties, Lewis kept at it. He put in immense amounts of time on the task. Whether he found the work interesting or thought it important cannot be said. It sufficed that Mr. Jefferson wanted it done. Lewis was relatively uninterested in Indian mythology or spiritual life, but he was a skilled observer of some parts of Indian culture, especially how things were done. One of his contributions, for example, was a graphic and precise description of glass bead making among the Arikaras. As the expedition prepared to depart for the mountains, the captains purchased a buffalo skin teepee to provide shelter for themselves, Charbonneau, Sacagawea, and Pomp. Lewis described it in his journal entry of April 7, 1805, in what James Rhonda characterized as one of the best descriptions yet drafted of that distinctive plains dwelling. In addition to their written descriptions, the captains gathered such objects as Arikara corn, tobacco seeds, mineral and botanical specimens, along with artifacts from Indian life, including bows, clothing, and painted robes, to be sent to Jefferson. Altogether, the amount of information they gathered, organized and presented in a systematic fashion to Jefferson, and beyond him to the scientific world, was enough to justify the expedition, even if it made not a single further contribution. The model for Lewis and Clark's report was Jefferson's Notes on the State of Virginia. Like that work, written a quarter century earlier, Lewis's description of Upper Louisiana was part guidebook, part travelogue, part booster-like promotion, part text to accompany the master map. Adding in Clark's contributions, the final report from Fort Mandan totaled something close to 45,000 words, almost book length. Jefferson's notes ran to some 80,000 words. Like Jefferson, Lewis began with a detailed account of the waterways, or, as he put it, a summary view of the rivers and creeks which discharged themselves into the Missouri, from the junction of that river with the Mississippi to Fort Mandan. As Jefferson had done for Virginia, Lewis described not only the tributaries but the people living along the rivers, whether the French at St. Charles, or the Otoes, or the Sioux. He included information on the local economy, the soil, mineral deposits, climate, and more. The report combined the captain's actual observations of the various rivers flowing into the Missouri with information received from traders and Indians about the upper reaches of those streams and their own principal tributaries. For example, Lewis saw only the mouth of the Platte River, but he described it up to its head in the mountains. From what he had been told, he said, the Platte ran through immense level and fertile plains and meadows in which no timber is to be seen except on its own borders. He named five major tributaries of the Platte, discussed the mineral deposits in its drainage, the soil, the people, Otoes and Missouris, and more. Naturally, the farther west Lewis's report ventured, the more speculative it became. His conjecture about the Platte's relationship to Santa Fe and to the Black Hills was purely imaginative and badly wrong. Lewis expected that Jefferson would have his work printed and distributed as a report to Congress, and he knew something about the audience for the work, so on occasion he sounded like a promoter writing a broadside. This river, the Muddy in eastern Missouri, waters a most delightful country. The land lies well for cultivation and is fertile in the extreme, covered with lofty and excellent timber, and supplied with an abundance of fine, bold springs of limestone water. The Grand River, farther west, was also prime farm country. The lands are extremely fertile, consisting of a happy mixture of prairies and groves, exhibiting one of the most beautiful and picturesque scenes that I ever beheld. Enthusiastic as he was in his report about the lower Missouri country, he made it sound almost like heaven, he actually was holding back his emotions. In his letter to his mother, dated March 21, 1804, he allowed himself to rhapsodize about the country, writing not so much as son to mother as Virginia planter to Virginia planter. "This immense river, so far as we have yet ascended," he wrote, "waters one of the fairest portions of the globe, nor do I believe that there is in the universe a similar extent of country, equally fertile, well watered, and intersected by such a number of navigable streams." He added, I had been led to believe that the open prairie country was barren, sterile, and sandy, but on the contrary, I found it fertile in the extreme, the soil being from 1 to 20 feet in depth, consisting of a fine black loam that produces a luxuriant growth of grass and other vegetables. The plains were not quite Eden, however. The absence of timber was a serious drawback, for it was almost unimaginable for any American in 1805 to live in a country without plenty of lumber and fuel. Indeed, in the eastern third of the United States, too much timber was the problem. In his report to Jefferson, Lewis took note of all the things that would spring to the mind of a frontier farmer hankering to move into Upper Louisiana. He pointed out several rapids well situated for waterworks. He warned against areas that had tolerably fertile soil but no timber. Lewis was an advance man for the American fur trappers and traders as well as farmers. He noted the furs available and scouted likely spots for trading posts. One of Lewis's responsibilities was to make recommendations on how to drive the British away from the Missouri so that American companies could take over the fur trade. His analysis of the economic-political situation on the river led him directly to his conclusion and recommendation. I am perfectly convinced that until such measures are taken by our government as will effectually prohibit all intercourse or traffic with the Sioux and the British fur companies, he reported to Jefferson, the citizens of the United States can never enjoy but partially those important advantages which the navigation of the Missouri now presents. He recommended establishing garrisons in places where the soldiers could stop the British.